Welcome into Hockey Mountain High, your go-to Avalanche podcast presented by Superbook Sports. JJ Jerez here, Arif Dean, and Ryan Boulding of NHL.com joins us to chat a little bit of hockey, right? I mean, we've been watching the Stanley Cup Finals unfold right before our eyes here, and I guess I've been really entertained, been fun hockey. I wish it could go a little longer of a series. Doesn't feel like it's going to, but Ryan, we haven't been able to catch up in a long time. How have you enjoyed these Stanley Cup Final, and how have you been spending your time watching them?
It's been good. I've been enjoying it. I wouldn't say that I'm necessarily rooting for either team. I found myself last night thinking, this is one of those series for me where you wish both teams could lose somehow, but they can't. So you're kind of stuck with it as it is.
Yeah, I texted JJ yesterday when it was 3-0, and I'm like, you know what? I'm over this series. It was fun for the first two periods of game one, and since then it's been one-sided and boring, and I'm ready for the offseason. And then like 7 minutes later it was 3-2. I'm like, of course Florida's going to make this a game. Obviously couldn't complete the comeback, and me thinks it'll be over on Tuesday, but we'll see.
Well, here's the thing. If you guys all remember when Jesse Montano ran around the Ball Arena and was sticking that camera in our faces right before playoffs started and asking us all our predictions, Ryan Boulding threw Vegas out there as, you know, the biggest threat, as maybe his Stanley Cup final, and he was the only one that chose them. And look at him. I know he's feeling good, patting himself on the back, having made that prediction. But Ryan, I guess get into Vegas a little bit. I mean, what made you see it early on in the playoffs, and why do you think you were the only one that called it?
Wait, did I really?
Yeah, you don't remember that in the
no.
in that little video that we
sure,
all put together?
I'm pretty sure when Ryan picked Vegas, he said, everybody else is picking Edmonton. Let me pick something different. I thought it was Dallas, but Vegas sounds right, too. I just remember him not picking Edmonton.
Ryan loves to be a contrarian.
My NHL bracket was Edmonton-Boston, so that's why I was like, did I pick Vegas? I think, you know, after round one on the hockey show, we were doing our little coronation bit, right? For whatever King Charles or whatever his name is. And that's when I said my king pick is the Vegas Golden Knights. So that's as far back as I remember thinking this team legit has it. And some of that is just what they were able to accomplish with a rotating goalie setup, right? Is a merry-go-round of goalies back there for them. And they won the West. They won their division. They, you know, really took it to the Jets, like have done a good job of getting through the postseason, putting their foot on the throat, their skate on the throat of opponents, right? All with whoever is in net, you know. Brassois was there, then he got hurt again. Now it's been the Aiden Hill show, and that just tells me, like, you know, if you felt like last year the Avalanche were the team of destiny, you know, like very little went wrong for them. Even when guys got hurt and got injured, they came back quickly. They made contributions. Obviously, Kadri is a big one. That's how Vegas seems to me. You know, nothing can kind of get in their way.
Yeah, I see that. I love the way that they have, you know, Jack Eichel has kind of been the quote-unquote best forward the whole way through, but now you got Jonathan Marchessault pitching in with all these goals. You have, obviously, Mark Stone, who's had moments here and there, and it kind of reminds me of last year's Avs, where at times it was the Val Nichushkin show, Nathan MacKinnon consistently scoring, Gabe Landeskog pitching in, Mikko Rantanen just assist after assist after assist, the big goals from Nazem Kadri, the big games from him, I should say. So it does remind me of that. I guess for me to back up my not picking Vegas pick, which is hilarious because of all the teams that they've played, it feels like Edmonton has given Vegas the biggest trouble at this point. Looking at the Golden Knights, like the Mark Stone thing, like I know they were kind of LTIRing it, but it's also like that dude's got serious back issues, but he seems to be doing his thing, and he's been great in the playoffs. And you know, Ivan Barbashev has been a spectacular fit. And it's funny you just mentioned Brossois and Aiden Hill, that none of those guys are the goalie that went to the All-Star game representing Vegas and Logan Thompson. And so there was just a lot of question marks around that too. But obviously, you know, they found a way through that. It seems like they're the team of destiny. And when you look at their lineup compared to the Florida Panthers, like it's night and day. And the Panthers have been exceptional, and they've got a lot of depth. But the Golden Knights are just stacked, it seems like, from top to bottom.
When you got Matt Tkachuk gets hurt, right, and he's not playing at 100% now, so that's going to affect the team. But I keep thinking, and I'm curious your guys' thoughts on this, every game that I watch Barbashev play, and he was traded, like his first game following the trade deadline was Colorado, mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure.
Yep,
because we had to go talk to him and get quotes from him. He looks like the best trade deadline acquisition of the year.
I said it before the playoffs started. I put out a tweet something about before he makes his mark on this series, I'm going to say it now, Ivan Barbashev. I think I worded it as like would be an exceptional fit with the Avalanche or would be such a great fit with the Avalanche, but it's pretty much that. It's the fact that he's been such a great trade deadline acquisition. He's exactly what pretty much any team needs. He reminds me of the guy that helped the Blues win it all in 2019 that had 60-something points in 1 year in the regular season and was a factor in the playoffs. Granted, that year he played on a line with, I think, Sundqvist and Steen. He was their fourth liner at the time. So he's really grown into that role. He's just needed the opportunity. He's getting it. And as we know from a season ago, he's a very physical dude in the playoffs. He broke Sam Girard's sternum right out of the postseason. And that mixed with this offensive touch, like, that is the ideal playoff performer. And it kind of reminds me of what you're seeing on the Panther side. And not necessarily Tkachuk, but like someone like Sam Bennett, who good player, but elevates in the playoffs and kind of it fits his game a little bit more. You're seeing that with Barbashev, and this dude has earned himself many millions of dollars because of his play the last 6 weeks.
Well, I want to dive a little bit deeper into the goaltending. You guys kind of both have brought it up already. And, you know, you look back at the Tampa Bay years of reign and when they were the dominant team. And I think everybody really had this idea of, okay, having a superstar goalie is super important. That's what you need to win. That's what you need to get a cup in this league. Then the last 2 years, we've seen Darcy Kuemper and Aiden Hill play great hockey, not taken away at all from the way they played, but not necessarily the quote-unquote big-name goaltender, right? I guess, are we trending towards maybe teams not necessarily having to big-name hunt when it comes to goaltending, but more so just solidifying the structure around them and, you know, hoping that the goalie plays well at the right time?
Yeah, I definitely think this is a trend that's been coming on for a while now. You know, you looked at the expansion market when the Avs exposed Calvin Pickard and he was taken by Vegas. Now, I'm not saying, you know, Pickard was the goalie for them or has resulted in having that kind of career, because that just hasn't really happened for him. But that was kind of the first moment for me where, you know, looking around the league, you started to see maybe it wasn't the big name guys making the, you know, the big $6 million contracts that were what teams needed, you know. And as it's gone on, I've become more confident that you need the right goalie for the right system. And the Avalanche have done a good job of doing that. They can take Philip Grubauer, right? They can take Darcy Kuemper. They can take Georgiev. Guys who, you know, largely haven't been battle-tested as a starter or have been battle-tested with a not a great team in front of them and turn them into, like, Vezina contenders, Stanley Cup winners, you know, like, really catapult these guys' careers and then weather that storm when that guy then gets the money he's deserved and leaves. They'll just bring in the next guy and do it again. And that, to me, tells me, like, there needs to be a good level of NHL skill. Right, you can't just do it with an AHL level guy, but with the right system around it, you can prop up a lower tiered goalie, I think, to success. Now, if we're looking at Georgiev with the Avalanche, I think he won that team a number of games they didn't deserve winning. You know, if we look back on the season now, so obviously his skill set is very high, and that's not to say like Aiden Hill's skills are low, but this was a guy who, you know, didn't make it with San Jose, who was on the downswing there, you know, in terms of their team and what he's been able to do in Vegas. Logan Thompson, Laurent Brossoit, like, to me, it's like, wow, if there's ever an example of what a good team can do with a medium tier goalie, it's this.
Yeah. I mean, the thing with Aiden Hill compared to Darcy Kuemper is, like, I know the eye injury and everything, but like Aiden Hill actually has exceptional numbers. He's got a 934 save percentage. He's kind of somewhere in that conversation for the Conn Smythe, though I don't think he'll be the one to win it. Darcy was nowhere near it last year. For me, to answer JJ's question, this just goes to show that you can build a Stanley Cup winner in many different ways. And that's just the reality of this sport. It's no two teams are ever going to be the same, because you look at someone like the Florida Panthers, if they won, not that the series is over, but like if they were to win, we would be taking a lot from that team. You know, maybe you just got to make the big trade. Maybe you just got to go out. Granted, you know, Vegas did the same thing with Jack Eichel. Maybe you just got to go out and do what my favorite thing, listening to Toronto Maple Leafs and radio in Toronto. It's, you know, look at what the Florida Panthers did. It reminds me of what the Raptors did when they traded DeMar for Kawhi. And you just got to go out and make the big trade. And that's what will get you a championship. But you look at the Avalanche, it's like, well, you can place any goalie in there, not even a 900 save percentage, and he'll get the job done if the rest of your team is stacked. But then you look at the Lightning, and they got Vasilevsky, who might be on the Mount Rushmore of goalies by the time it's all said and done for his career. And it just says to me that depending on the system you play, depending on the team you have, you can win in any number of ways. I mean, the Florida Panthers, yeah, they're down 3-1, but they're in the Stanley Cup final with guys like Gustav Forsling and Mark Stahl playing big minutes. Josh Mahura's in their top six. When last year, before the Jack Johnson injury, before Jack Johnson replaced Sam Girard because of that injury, like everybody on the Avalanche was someone that you could say could be a top four defenseman on another team. And this was with Eric Johnson at like the height of his, you know, the older Eric Johnson, the height of that person's powers before he kind of took a dip this year. So I just think there's any number of ways to win. Vegas has figured out something with their goaltending this year. Where the Robin Leonard injury ends up not bothering them at all, because they've been able to throw any number of guys into there. But it doesn't take away from the Tampa Bay Lightning being able to build a third and fourth line out of guys making $1 million or 1.8 for Blake Coleman's case, and just having depth up and down the lineup, but also having a $9.5 million all-star in goal. It's whatever works for your team. You know, the Nashville Predators could win a cup with someone like UC Saros stealing the show. The Vegas Golden Knights can win a cup with 3-4 goalies, you know, mixing and matching and playing when needed.
There's another couple of things for Florida, too. One, it's interesting to me to mention the go out and make the big move, because I read an interview with Bill Zito, and it might have been ESPN with Greg Wyshynski. I'm not sure where I was reading this, but he basically said, you know, there's the perception that we went out and made a big move, but the reality of it was we went out and made the right move, you know, and it's a big move at the time because you don't know how it's going to work out. But bringing in Matt Tkachuk has been a big move and the right move for them. And part of that was going out and finding the, you know, identifying that he is the type of player, all around guy, that they need, not just on the ice, but in the locker room. He takes care of the trainers. You know, he immediately came to town and he took all the training staff out to dinner, you know, before the season started, like that kind of stuff. A guy who knows how to take care of everyone in the support staff, I think, is important. And then, I mean, don't forget when Florida walked in, it was this season, Sergei Bobrovsky had lost his job to Spencer Knight. And in the middle of the season, Spencer Knight enters the player assistance program, right? So now they're down to Alex Lyon and Sergei Bobrovsky. Bobrovsky gets hurt, so Lyon takes this team into the postseason and plays until he gets replaced by a healthy Bobrovsky, who had not played a lot of games this year. So he's also very rested, but now we're seeing, you know, the Sergei renaissance too. Like, it seems like on these kind of playoff runs, like you mentioned, Eric Johnson having a renaissance year, we're seeing that from Bobrovsky. And I say this all the time, but this was a guy with a, you know, a mostly a legacy of underperforming in high pressure situations, right? And he has been unbelievably good.
I really like the idea of what you said, Arif. I mean, there's no real one way to build a Stanley Cup champion. I mean, in the NHL, you see it all the time. It's a copycat league, and they see a guy like Cale Makar, and suddenly the NHL, every team thinks they need a Cale Makar in order to be a Stanley Cup champion. But the thought of there's no, you know, no two Stanley Cup champions are exactly alike, you know, I really like that, and I like the concept of just like, yes, there's a big part of building your team the right way, but then there's also the factor of health. There's a factor of a goaltender playing hot at the right moment. I mean, so many things have to go correctly to create and cultivate a Stanley Cup champion. It's not just simply, oh, let's copy last year's champion and that should work out for us.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite example of that is looking at the Chicago Blackhawks when they won three cups in 5 years, which was six seasons. The first year they did it with a ton of depth. You know, they had Andrew Ladd, Dustin Byfuglien, Chris Versteeg. They were all depth players on that roster that all ended up leaving that summer and getting big contracts elsewhere. In goal, they had a guy named Antti Niemi, who in the regular season wasn't all that well. And in the playoffs, I think he was a 9, last I checked, I remember looking at it the other day, he was around 9.10, maybe 9.05 save percentage. Here it is. Yeah, he was a 9.10 in the postseason with two shutouts. So he didn't really steal the show by any means, but still ended up getting picked up by the San Jose Sharks that offseason. So the Blackhawks had a ton of depth up and down the lineup. They had a strong defense. They had guys in their prime like Kane and Taves and Keith and all them on good contracts before they cashed out. And they had, you know, a goalie in net that could just kind of do it. And going up against Philadelphia, who had Brian Boucher and, I believe, Michael Layton, like, doing it on their side to will that team to the Stanley Cup final. Then they go into the offseason. Like I said, they lose Versteeg, they lose Byfuglien, they lose Andrew Ladd, they lost Antti Niemi. They had to kind of rebuild this roster and came back in 2013 and relied even more on their defense and had Corey Crawford kind of solidify the crease and sign a five-year deal there and stick around. I believe he was making $6 million a year, which was, you know, at the time a lot for a goalie and still kind of is, but especially when the cap was lower. And then 2015 ran it back again, where they went heavy on the top four. It was Oduya, Chalmerson, Keith, and Seabrook playing pretty much every other shift. And I think Kimmo Tiiminen was their sixth defenseman and played like 4 or 5 minutes a night. And just in that one team, in the five-year stretch with the same core, we saw Chicago have to kind of reinvent themselves twice and focus on a different way of winning a championship. And how familiar does that sound to the Avalanche? Because Colorado does not have Kadri and Burakovsky and Kemper and all the guys they lost, and they're about to lose some more. They may or may not bring back Evan Rodriguez. They're probably going to lose JT Compher. There's a lot of veterans on this team, from Helm to Jack to Eric to Cogliano. There's a lot of guys that they're going to be missing. For the Avalanche to be Stanley Cup contenders again, they're going to have to reinvent themselves. They're not going to be able, probably, to do it again with a goalie that has less than a 900 save percentage. They're going to need, kind of like this year, the stars to have a bigger impact, not as much as they did in 2023 against Seattle, because that was a little out of hand how many minutes they were playing. But it just goes to show that even within the same team, when you look at the Blackhawks, they had to change the way they played, and they had to change their formula in order to reach the pinnacle.
I think, too, when it comes to team construction, the only constants are, you know, an identity for the group, or, you know, maybe multiple identities depending on the lines, and quality support players. Like, it's not just the stars getting things done, right? Like, you look for Florida, Matt Tkachuk has been a big gamer for them, and I would say he's a star, but Brandon Montour is having a great season. You know, Sam Bennett, like we talked about before, has been huge. Like, they're getting contributions from other guys. So is Vegas. You know, so did the Avalanche when they went through and won. And then my favorite thing about what you mentioned, the Blackhawks, I'm not sure that it ended up screwing them initially, but I'm sure it ended up screwing them in the longer term, was, never forget, San Jose wanted either Niemi or Chalmerson, and so they offer sheeted Chalmerson.
Yeah, I remember that.
And Chicago matched, right? And they took Niemi. I think it's hilarious. Like, we're going to get one of these two guys, and we're going to force you to keep one.
Yeah, so I forgot about that. They couldn't even qualify Niemi at the end because of the Chalmerson deal. Oh, man, I remember that.
Ryan Boulding's very wise. I mean, he's been around the game for a long time. I'm entering my 10th season covering this team, and there's only one guy that's been there as long, and you've been there longer, and that's you, Ryan. So that's kind of the next conversation I wanted to get into. I mean, in your time in the Colorado Avalanche press box, so much change has happened. I guess
we don't even sit in the same spots anymore. That's how much change has happened.
Yeah, the entire press box has actually moved, as a matter of fact. So I guess, yeah, just blanket thought on the change that you've seen over the years and, you know, from coaches. We're actually going to get into coaches later, but, you know, from the name of the arena to different teams, different general managers, and just, you know, the people in the press box itself.
Yeah, I've seen so much. I was actually, I can't think of it. Must have been, it was either a morning skate or like a practice day during the playoffs. And instead of like rushing ahead to get to the media room, there would be a couple times where I'd come out and Jared Bednar would be, you know, coming out of the coach's room. Instead of rushing off, I would just walk behind him because I'm like, well, I know it's going to start, you know, as soon as I walk in there. And we were walking and we were like halfway around the building. And, you know, a lot of construction has been going on because they're building that indoor outdoor points bet bar, restaurant, whatever. So we're always like navigating, not dying in the hallway there, jumping over, you know, caverns and stuff. And, I said, Jared, do you remember when we used to do the, I said, I bet you miss doing the press conferences in the old conference room, because it was like, you know, an eighth of the travel to the media room. But the media room was, I mean, it had, I think, 16 seats, maybe. I only know that because it was my job to make sure that was in good shape, that room. But like 16 seats, it had room for three media cameras at most. You know, everybody used to stand to the side. I think there's an old picture that I had or someone had with JJ. He's like leaning up against the wall, Mike Chambers style, in the media room. You know, it was a little broom closet before, and now they're doing it in like the media lounge. They've got the digital displays in the back, you know, the huge podium. I mean, yeah, the Stanley Cup final, there's a lot of media in town, right? But last year, I mean, even outside of round one, a lot of media was present. There was, at the start of the Kraken series, I was almost struck by, I mean, I know they had a lot of local people travel, but just how few media were there, you know, for them, especially when the series came back, you know, and all the local TV budgets had blown their travel, or the TV stations had blown their travel budget. So it was just like the newspaper and then us, you know. I was thinking about that the other day, how weird that was. But yeah, I don't know if you remember, JJ, you remember the old media room and just being packed in there?
Absolutely. But I also remember way less people being in there, right? I mean, it was you who was part of the PR team, Rob Knabenbauer, who was your partner,
and Ron.
Then, like, Ron, sorry, Ron. And he would yell at me if he heard me say that. It was me, AJ, Mike Chambers, and Rick Sadowski, who is actually the guy you replaced in your job at NHL.com. Rest his soul, of course. But yeah, it was a very small group, and you know, I wouldn't say
Drew Demo for a little bit there.
Yeah, I wouldn't say we were very tight knit like we are now, but it was just interesting, you know, really only being four or five of
us. Yeah, I think the constant change there is I moved here and we all became a happy family in the Avalanche won a cup.
Arif was the glue.
I was the Ivan Barbashev, so you're welcome.
We all could unite in how much we disliked Arif, right?
Honestly, I'm breaking
it. It was so much a different time. Like, you know, I don't know if the video exists anymore. Maybe we can get someone on the digital team to see if the old Avs media drive still exists and smuggle out the video. But they actually, there is video that exists of the J.S. Jaguar. They're more worried about their Vegas trip than winning the rest of the season. There's video, and I've seen it, that the Avs have of that hasn't seen the light of day because obviously it wasn't very flattering. You know, those kinds of situations in the old locker room and the old press room days. I remember Patrick Waugh yelling about Semyon Varlamov not getting one of the three stars of the game once. And he came in. We asked like two, three questions. You know, obviously it hadn't been a good game, really. And he goes, "Is that it?" And we're like, "Yeah." And he's like, "I got a question for you guys then. Who's picking the three stars, and how do you not pick Varlamov?" And we're all sitting there like, and Adrian Dater, I'll never forget, he goes, "Well, it wasn't us." And Waugh goes, "I know who it was," and stormed out of the little media room, you know. But like, you really, you felt like the fear of being yelled at in that tiny, tiny room with nowhere to go.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
I remember that 2013, that Jean-Sébastien Jaguar quote where he ripped the team for their Vegas trip. I'll never forget that because that was obviously the shortened season in 2013. It was right around the time that I was graduating with my bachelor's degree, and I was young and dumb and thought, hey, you graduate on a Monday and, you know, by Friday you have your dream job. And I just remember thinking, man, I'm going to go into that locker room and I'm going to hear quotes like that. Like, that would be the coolest thing to cover. Lo and behold, by the time I was there, Jaeger was long gone, retired. But I just remember the impact of that quote and how crazy it was to read the stories of the, I don't care about your Vegas trips right now. You know, it was April. The team was nowhere close to the playoffs. They were obviously one of the worst teams in the NHL. That's the draft that ended up being the Nathan MacKinnon pick, which, you know, people don't like to mention this when they talk about the draft lottery screwing the Avalanche out of the number one pick twice. But Florida Panthers should have gotten that pick, and it should have been MacKinnon to Florida, maybe Barkov to Colorado. So I just remember Jaeger having that pride and me thinking, like, man, this is a guy that 10 years ago won the Conn Smythe Trophy and on a losing team. He's such a pro's pro, just a veteran guy, and this team is letting him down. And here we are talking about that being 10 years ago already.
Yeah, I mean, that right there just shows you the change that Ryan has seen in this team, right? I mean, you look back at that group of guys, the 2013 Avalanche, and they're almost reminiscent of the Waterboy cheerleaders to me, right? Just a bunch of dudes that love to hit the bottle and were more interested in partying than they were winning hockey games. And now the caliber of hockey team that we have in Colorado now with, you know, Nathan MacKinnon driven, no nonsense, and really do everything you can to be the best champion you can. I mean, that has alone has to be the biggest eye-opening change that you've witnessed in your tenure as a Avalanche media member.
What changed? I'm really curious, Ryan, because I've often heard about this team kind of being, they were slow to the punch with the analytics thing. Their draft and development really hasn't improved all that much. Was it Jared Bednar? Was it Joe Sakic? Was it getting rid of Sacco? Or was it getting like Sherman? Like, what changed to cause this? Or was it just getting a couple guys in the draft between overall picks 1 and 3, and that was the turning point? Like, what is it to you?
You know, I think it's a handful of things. First, I want to say I've only been retweeted by Elliot Friedman twice in my life, and once was a follow-up question that Julie Brownman asked that I tweeted the answer to Jaeger, where she said, is it a lack of effort or a lack of talent? And I'm pretty sure, I'd have to go back and look, I'm pretty sure Jaeger goes, well, it's not a lack of talent. And you're like, okay, we got there. And the other time was some dude was chirping the Avalanche team account, and the Blue Jays had just lost, and his bio pick was a Blue Jays hat. And I just tweeted him back, sorry about the Jays, bro. And Elliot Friedman retweeted that and was like, that's a good burn. And I was like, oh, I feel so good about myself. I think if you look back on it from in a 10-year span, let's say, from 2013 pre-MacKinnon drafts to post-Avs winning their third Stanley Cup, I would say the number one thing that has changed, I think, is just the entirety of the game of hockey and everything about it, you know, which is a bit of a cop-out answer, but we're talking technology, right? All overall, like player tracking technology, analytics tracking technology, we're talking scouting technology, all of those things, you know. I think before you know, the ubiquity of YouTube and video software like that. Like, yeah, I'm aware YouTube launched in like 2009, right? And you could find clips of guys in 2013, but things didn't exist like they do now. You know, scouting software where you could go in and watch a bunch of clips existed. But like now, like Mile High Sports could buy software that allows you to watch every player's every shift from a single season type of stuff, right? Like that stuff was kind of on the forefront. Remember, John Chyka got named GM of the Arizona Coyotes from his Stathletes analytics company. And in, I don't know, 2015, Tim Army, who was an assistant coach at the time, and I sat in on a conference call with Chyka talking about what Stathletes offered. And he gave us a demo of the software and everything. And I remember thinking when he was named GM, like, holy cow, we had a meeting with this guy to talk about his company. And now he is a general manager in the league. Like, this is crazy. This is how things have changed. And just seeing the capabilities of the software at the time was kind of mind-blowing to me. Like, all of this stuff is out here. You can see it. You have this information on hand very quickly, you know. But it's expensive. And there is a, I would say, a relative assumption, I imagine, among owners and management that you have to be in a sort of relatively competitive position to spend the money on stuff like that, right? So when you look at it, you're like, could the Avalanche have spent the money they spent in 2022 in 2013 and done well? I don't think they could have. I don't think that they could have spent that money. I don't think it would have been an efficient spending of that money. You know what I mean? But that's, it's kind of a catch-all for all the things you mentioned, right? Like, is it drafting? Is it player development? Like, was it coaching? I don't know. I think it was a combination of those things. But you can go back further than that. We always used to talk about how Paul Stastny was incredible when he played with Milan Hajduk, right? Yeah. But Paul Stastny was not incredible when he played with David Jones. And that's kind of, you know, you see that in the playoffs now. You see it in the postseason now. Who's playing with who? Like, I like to talk to people about the Avs this year and say they're Val Nichushkin away from getting to the second round. I don't think that they win the second round, you know, but they missed his contributions and didn't really get any, you know, from many guys down the lineup. So I guess the biggest thing that has changed, you're right, that season was so bad it got them Nathan MacKinnon, and that's a huge piece, right? That's a generational talent that you can build around, and that's what this team has done. But you also saw a lot of stopgap years where, like, Nate Gennon, great guy, love the guy, he was super awesome. He went to San Diego, he played for the San Diego Gulls, and I was a finalist for a job there, and I actually texted him and talked to him about the organization and the city, you know, and he was like, it's awesome. Not really an NHL defenseman, right? But he was a guy that had to fill a role for the organization for a handful of years because they didn't have anybody coming down the pipeline and they couldn't get anybody to sign here. And that's another part of it. I forget, was it Curtis Glencross that did a PTO with the Avs like midseason? So I'm pretty sure that year they offered Glencross a contract. And he was like, no, I don't like the contract. I'm going to go the tryout route like Jack Johnson did. You know, I'm going to try and sign with a team out of training camp and earn a better contract. And it didn't work. And then when he came and did a PTO with the Avs, he was terrible.
Yeah.
And you're like, good God, could you have imagined if he had signed the contract they offered him?
Yeah.
Just bad. Another one was that. Who was it? Brooks Orpik left the Penguins, right, and signed with the Capitals. Avs tried to get him, and he was like, nope.
Really?
Not interested. Now, the Capitals were further along, you know, than the Avalanche were at the time, but it's one of those things where you look and you're like, what would have adding Brooks Orpik done to this team? Like, it would have helped them take it to the next level, I think.
Yeah, I mean,
but those are the kind of things.
That's around the time that they were, I think, when they added Beauchemin, I want to say.
It may have been.
Or maybe
it
Haida,
may have been
somewhere
the...
between Haida and Beauchemin, or maybe a little after that.
Well, don't forget Brad Stewart, right? Oh. I mean, there was kind of a plethora of just underwhelming defensemen continually coming into the organization that you're like, one of these guys is going to hit. And it wasn't until the arrival of Cale Makar that you finally felt at peace with the defensive group that was here. And so, I mean, I guess to jump into the conversation, I feel like Cale Makar was that piece that really took this franchise to the next
level. I would go a little bit more than that. I would say it was a little bit before Cale, because if you remember, like, right now the Avalanche, we know them when it comes to drafting and developing, is the team that can't figure out a goaltender. You know, they've had to trade a first rounder for Varley, a second rounder for Grubauer, a first rounder for Kemper, a third and a fifth for Georgiev. Like, they're constantly trading draft picks for goalies. But I'm 29 years old. When I was like 25, the thing the Avalanche were known for was they can't draft and develop a defenseman. Now suddenly you got Byram and Makar. I know higher picks. It's a little bit easier than that. They obviously traded for Devon Taves at a decently young age. But it was the acquisition of Sam Girard to me was the first time that it was like, holy crap, they have this 19-year-old rookie defenseman. Like, we saw them have the 18-year-old Duchesnes and O'Reillys and the 19-year-old Landeskog early in his rookie season. And we saw MacKinnon come in as an 18-year-old and put up 10 points in the playoffs. But a teenage defenseman was kind of unheard of. And it takes me, obviously, to the Matt Duchesne trade. I think the Matt Duchesne trade was a big one for me because, obviously, you got a lot of things for it, but it did two things specifically for me. It gave them Sam Girard, which for the first time, the biggest thing about the Sam Girard acquisition wasn't the player himself. He was good. He wasn't great yet, but he was good. It was, like you said, Brad Stewart, Jan Hayda, Francois Beauchemin. The Avalanche kept bringing in these older veterans to stick with a younger-ish kind of Eric Johnson. And none of them worked. And for the first time, EJ was playing with this kid that you looked at and said, he's got a brighter future than Eric. And they just never had that. And at the same time, what it also did was it kind of led, I guess, by accident in a way, to the line of Landeskog, MacKinnon, Rantanen. Because if you remember, even before the Duchesne trade in the 16-17 season, like, it was a rookie Rantanen with MacKinnon at center and Sven Andrighetto. Like, they still had these weird combinations of lines. And like you were saying, Ryan, like, it was about who can play with who. Paul Stastny was great with Milan Hayduk, not good with David Jones. The Avalanche finally found this combination that they can build around. And it was 92, 29, and 96. It was that top line that we still haven't really created a good name for and won't need to for another year with Landeskog out. But it was the Duchesne trade and giving them someone like Sam Girard, forming this line, and then kind of going from there. Because outside of Sam Girard, like, they didn't really solve any immediate needs in the lineup. Yeah, they got a draft pick here and a draft pick there that led to Byram, that, you know, they had Shane Bowers with all this promise and all these other pieces. But in the lineup, all they really got was Duchesne for a 19-year-old Sam Girard. And as soon as you traded Duchesne, you were now in the market for a second-line center because Jostein Kamfer didn't take that next step, and then you have to go get Nazem Kadri. So it's not like you got three or four pieces right away that entered your lineup for Matt Duchesne.
In some other defensive moves, it wasn't just old guys. You had a younger Nick Holden come in and do okay. And I remember watching him shut Ovechkin down in a game back on the other side of the – and, like, yeah, the old – I think the old side of the press box. I think Nick Holden was there before I joined the team. Watching him shut Ovechkin down. Cody Golubov, right? Like, some guys who came through.
Patrick Weirkosh.
What's his name? Dougie Hamilton's brother.
Freddie
Hamilton coming through. And you're like, oh, maybe Dougie Hamilton's coming to the team because they're going the brother route. You know, like when Ryan O'Reilly went to Buffalo, his brother went with him.
Yeah.
You know, like, there were components like that. When Seth Jones went to Chicago, so did Caleb Jones, right? Some of those things are important to these guys. But, you know, it's sometimes it's a crapshoot, I think, and it's a roll of the dice, and some things pan out and some things don't. You know, Duncan Siemens was projected to be a really good prospect, and just things didn't pan out for him. Chris Bigra was projected to be a really good player, and I think he got a concussion, and that was kind of it for him. Like, he had a hard time recovering. One-for-one trade with Ryan Graves, who parlayed some turnaround success into Colorado into a pretty big role with the Devils. Will Butcher, you know, and the stuff that happened with him. It's interesting. It comes back, like you mentioned, the Matt Duchesne trade, and the thing that bugs me the most about how fans just hate him is this revisionist narrative that he quit on the team. And you're like, no, he didn't quit. I mean, he asked for a trade. If that's quitting on the team, then he quit on the team, right? But he didn't quit out on the ice. And he asked for a trade. And he was patient enough to let the Avalanche find a trade that catapulted this team to the next level. You know what I mean? But it's all of those things. It's drafting Mikko Rantanen in 10th, right? And you're like, how is this going to work? Like, that's the same draft as Provorov, and he just got traded. You know, people are like, wow, he's really not panning out in Philly. I mean, Philly's on the down, but the next year, it's Tyson Jost. And that hasn't really worked out, you know? And then the year after that is Cale Makar. And you're just like, yeah, I think most teams at the top would want a do-over where they could take Cale Makar instead of who they picked. But some of it is you got lucky in draft order. Some of it is maybe you scouted this guy harder than others. You know, some of it is you find a guy like Cale Makar who is not just a good player, but he's also a good person, and he's a hardworking person, and he's a kid who stayed in college because he didn't think he was ready for the pro game, and that vastly helped him. And that may have helped Tyson Jost. You know, there was always questions later, like, did Tyson Jost leave North Dakota too soon? Hard to say. But, I mean, those are the kind of things where some of it is just luck, I think. And you look at Florida, like, they've drafted almost none of the players who are on their team. You look at a team like Dallas, I mean, they took Jake Ottinger, was a first-round pick, wasn't he? I'm pretty sure he was, without pulling it up. Like, that's bold. You rarely see teams draft goalies very high, and I feel like it doesn't pan out a lot. Like, we'll see on some of the younger guys who get taken early, but that's kind of where it comes down to. And then, I don't know, like, a lot of development, it seems like, doesn't happen anymore with the original organization. Like, you see some guys grow, but you see a guy like Tage Thompson move around and all of a sudden have this, you know, trajectory year that changes his whole life. You see when Kyle Dubas, the rumor comes out that Kyle Dubas and Brendan Shanahan had a rift because Dubas wanted to offer a fifth rounder for Tage Thompson and Shanahan didn't. You're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Could you imagine if he had had the year he had this year on Toronto? Gone, that team.
Yeah,
that team's going to the moon. But that's, you know, other things I've seen since then are the like you said, analytics. Patrick Waugh always kept track of, like, Corsi. He kept track of advanced analytics, so it always killed me when he would kind of bash him publicly, you know, because I was like, Ron and I would do Corsi for him post game. Like, we would to a spreadsheet. We would go through and track it out and send it to him every game. And then he would go out and be like, I don't know, you could call a shot from a guy getting on the ice at the center ice, a shot on goal. And you're just like, why are you doing this? I literally talked to Chris McFarland once and I'm like, can you get the guy to just stop talking about advanced analytics in public? That's all. Like, he just needs to not address it and everything will be fine.
I'll never forget that moment because it was off of a question that I asked, and it was a question that was so softball. It was just a simple, what happened to the shots there against the LA Kings? And he just went off on Corsi's and Fenway's. And just, I'll never forget that. Cause I'm like, what did I say to have him, go off on that? But yeah, let's get into Patrick.
Before you get into Patrick Waugh, I just want to say, cause I'm excited for this part of the show, but when you talk about Tyson Jost not staying a year extra and Cale Makar doing it, it often reminds
Hold on. Just kidding. I just wanted to interrupt.
I mean, I do it 17 times an episode to everybody else.
Unfortunately for Arif, I have the control tonight, and we are going to interrupt his interruption with a quick little read from Superbook Sports, just to have some fun with these summer shows here. And of course, if you want to have even more fun, you got to join Superbook Sports. Bring that big bet energy this summer with Superbook Sports. Superbook Sports is the most trusted name in sports betting. And right now, use promo code MILEHIGH to score up to $250 with their first bet bonus. Win or lose, they will match your first bet up to $250 with promo code MILEHIGH. Simply visit superbook.com for terms and conditions or download the Superbook Colorado app in the app stores. Enter the promo code MILEHIGH and you'll get $250 courtesy of Superbook Sports. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-522-4700. Back to the show. And Arif, I guess.
When you had the Tyson Jost coming up too early and, you know, all the decisions that this team had to make like that, I often think back to, you know, in the early 2010s and in the late 2000s, the Detroit Red Wings had this, like, aura and this
this, here we go. Everybody's turning off the show now.
This reputation of over, I guess, developing their players, like Nyquist and Tatar didn't enter the NHL till they were 25 and all this bullcrap, and it was really because they didn't have cap space and had a lot of players under contract. But one of the big differences that I've noticed when you compare Tyson Jost to Cale Makar, when you compare even someone like Tyson Jost to someone like Sean Behrens, who might be a player and we haven't even heard about him wanting to sign a contract anytime soon, it's this team doesn't have the urgency. Hell, here's another one. Naming Gabe Landeskog captain as a 19-year-old for some reason. Like, not that he's a bad captain, but just kind of rushing into that decision where the team was just so bad, there was an urgency to rush things, to try to capture a headline with the Gabe Landeskog thing, to rush players to the NHL, where now you can kind of hang out a little bit because you are a contender. There's no urgency for Sean Behrens to sign a contract today and figure it out in the NHL in 5 months. It's, we got Taves, we got Byram, we got Makar, we got Girard, we got Manson. We might lose one or two of these guys in the next 12 to 24 months. At that time, Behrens, you're up. And there is a little bit less of an urgency to rush into things because you've kind of figured out the main group, where it kind of is a little reminiscent of the Red Wings being like, oh, Tatar at 25 will give you 30 goals. At 21, he probably sucks, so let's just let him simmer in the AHL for 3 or 4 years because we don't need him yet because we have a team already.
And I don't think Jost and Makar are of the same caliber of talent.
Of course.
Just like I don't think Behrens is either, you know. But also, it breaks perceptions when a guy like Cale Makar signs out of college and then scores immediately and goes on this tear in the playoffs and then wins the Calder and the Conn Smythe. And then all of a sudden the expectation is, why doesn't everybody just stay in college an extra year and then come out like that? Well, they're not Cale Makar, who is, you know, prototypical.
Here's a fun statistic for you. Brett Hull, up until 2006, when he played whatever handful of games with the Phoenix Coyotes before retiring, he was the only player in the NHL that had more playoff years than regular season years because he made the postseason every single year of his career. And that's exactly what you have with Cale Makar right now. As long as the Avalanche somehow make the playoffs every year of his career, wherever he ends up, if he doesn't play here his entire career, he played in the playoffs in 2019, 20, 21, 22, 23. He's got 5 years of postseason, 4 years of regular season. As long as that trend continues, he will always be known as a player that played more in the playoffs than the regular season because he came right in, made an impact, and ever since then, the team has been a juggernaut.
But was his skate in the crease, yes or no?
It absolutely was, and he's a troll, and it's hilarious. Poor Buffalo.
So Patrick Waugh.
Yeah, let's get into this one. I've been
excited. Let's get JJ back. He's just looking at houses right now on his computer.
I'm just waiting for Arif. Wherever Arif wants to take the show, we'll go there.
Oh, okay, good. We are at 46 minutes, so let's continue to not talk about Patrick Waugh so that we can get over an hour and JJ can get a little antsy. I'm just kidding. Let's go to Patrick Waugh.
All right, Ryan, as you know, he was in the news this week kind of expressing his regret with the way he left Colorado. I guess you were kind of part of that PR staff with the Avalanche and the team when all this unfolded. What's your memory, what stands out to you the most of when Patrick Waugh left, and then maybe we can dive a little bit more into his tenure while he was here?
Yeah. Ron and I were at DU because it was their like pro days skate, you know. They had like a lot of pros from the league, like Tyler Bozak, Paul Stastny, guys would come and skate there with the varsity guys and just run through practices before going to their teams. And Ron and I were there. Zadorov was back. He was skating there. So we were going to talk to Zadorov and some of the guys. And I remember, this is a random aside, Adrian Wiedemann, he played at DU when I was there as a student. And he had moved back to town after playing overseas in Europe. And we were going to connect. And like, he was walking across the concourse and I got a phone call that was like, you need to come back to Ball Arena right now. And is it hailing at your house?
Yeah.
Yeah. It just hailed.
I don't know
so
if it's
hard.
Hail. I'm in a basement, but
I'm in the basement and it was hailing so hard I could hear it
that
at my house.
Wild.
I got a phone call that was like, you guys need to come back to Pepsi Center right now. And Ron and I used to joke that when those things happened, that we were going to get fired. It was always like, oh, we're getting fired today. So that tells you, you know, how we felt about the security of our jobs on the daily basis.
You guys are both passing back and forth a bottle of vodka on your way back.
Like, woo, it's yeah. over.
Here it is. It's finally happening. And we walk in and they're like, Patrick Waugh just resigned. And you're just like, what? What do you mean? Like, what happened?
And, Tyson Berry. That's yeah, what like, happened.
He put it basically called it was like, I'm done. And the Avs tried to convince him to change his mind or to hold off. And he was like, okay, I'll give you an hour. And then had his PR firm release the news. And it was
oh,
just,
so he actually called the team before that PR release went out.
Yeah. There was enough of a heads up and we were scrambling. Like Jean Martineau was in the air. So, you know, we kind of need to wait for his lead because he is the big boss. And I believe Josh Kroenke was in the air also. So it was one of these situations where, like, it's kind of panic time. It's kind of like build your chops as PR professional time, but you're also handcuffed by the fact that, you know, like the leadership is unavailable.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the Avs took a lot of heat for just not saying anything for a long period of time. I remember, and that was part of the reason was you're like, you know, for a PR strategy, you have to have all your ducks in a row. You can't just go out and start piecing it together in public. So it was hectic, you know, a lot of time spent in the conference room on my level, a lot of time doing nothing because you're just waiting for the tweet this or say this or do this thing. But it was just shocking. You know, it felt like, for whatever the reason is, I think there's a million reasons that people have assumptions about, just the same as why Matt Duchene wanted out or whatever, right? There's a million stories, and I was there, and I can't tell you any which one was true or not true, but it was just a tough time. And then you're conducting a protracted coaching search in August, you know, and it was like, this isn't a position we thought we'd be in. I'm trying to remember who came in. I think
Kevin Dineen.
Corey Hirsch. Kevin Dineen.
Lane Lambert, who's now the coach of the
Lane
Islanders.
Lane Lambert's one I remember. And I remember Jared Bednar coming in for the interview. And like
there was
us
one more.
Being in the front office, you know, we were asked, like, what did you guys think? Who did you like? And I was like, I like Bednar. You know, it's not like I was sitting in on the interviews and getting to experience. It was experiencing a person like coming through and leaving the office and what little research we did in their biography and, you know, that kind of thing. And I liked Jared Bednar at the time and he got hired. And one of the things I thought was pretty cool of him was right after they announced he was hired, they wanted him to record a video for season ticket holders. Season ticket holders are obviously a priority for any organization. So I had to call him up and be like, hey, will you record a video, you know, about being the head coach, and it's for season ticket holders, and like, here are the bullet points to cover, and can you record it this way and not that way, and like, send it to me. And he did that, and I sent it to marketing, and they sent it to the, you know, it's just funny to think now, like, Jared Bednar's not doing that stuff.
Yeah.
He had like, he's a well-dressed beast of a coach that won a Stanley Cup and has a lot of respect to his name and doesn't get asked those little things. But that, you know, being a first time NHL head coach, new to the organization, he was great to work with. And yeah, well, I don't want to get too much into him because I know we're talking Patrick Waugh, but that's kind of like, those are kind of the memories you go through. I sent Patrick an email after he left just saying, you know, like, it was an honor to work with you. It was great to work with you for the couple years that I did, you know.
Did he respond?
Yeah, he said, I appreciate your passion for the logo. Like, for us, it was always about
God, I love Patrick Waugh. He's such a jerk. Well, he's so great.
Well, it was always about the brand, right? Like, the more important than any one component was the legacy of the Avalanche. And so that, I think that causes problems sometimes with a company as big as KSE, where they try to run everything by committee. And I think it's sometimes something a lot of people don't understand, but like that was the main focus. Like, how do you protect this thing?
Yeah.
I guess I have so many different directions we could take this conversation in. Especially the obvious, right, with the Nichushkin stuff. Maybe we'll have time for it, maybe not. But I guess just working with Patrick Waugh during the times that, you know, were a little less turbulent, he, as Arif just said, right, he comes off as a real jerk, but also a real great guy. I mean, is that exactly the perception you have carried with you this time, having, you know, spent more time with him than the average Joe?
Yeah, I would like to say that I think I'm pretty observant when I am observing, you know, like I think there are times where I'm like, I'm doing this thing, like maybe we're at morning skate and I'm like, I'm setting up my lineup stuff, and then something happens and everybody's like, oh, did you see that? And I'm like, no, because I'm doing this other thing, right? But when you're observing something, you're paying attention to all the details in real time, you know, and definitely you get a sense of the person who is not the public figure, right? You get to see, everyone knows that it's winning, nothing else, right? For Patrick Waugh, winning is the most important thing. I don't think there's ever a question in any public or private experience with that man that is not the case.
Yeah.
But you do get to see a side of him as a person that many people don't get to see. You know, maybe you get to see some regret for things in life. He comes out and says what he says to NHL.com in his interview, and you know, he says, maybe I didn't handle things as well as I could have, right? Like, but you get to see that person. You get to see a person evolving from their on-ice persona into NHL head coach persona. You get to see a guy changing from who everyone knew him as before to something else. And so, you know, without like super specifics in situations, I got to experience some of that, you know, that colored how I view him. You know, but at the same time, you look and you're like, okay, the rumor was Patrick Waugh is going to be the next head coach of the Rangers, right? For like a week. That was word on the street, was he was a candidate. And you think like, I don't know. I mean, the way he burned the bridge on the way out, I don't know that is going to be the organization, right? Like, I could have seen Montreal doing it, giving it a Hail Mary legacy thing. But I think, you know, he could end up back in the NHL, but I think it's going to be an earn it type of job, you know, like not necessarily Anaheim, but, you know, Anaheim signs Greg Cronin. And it's like, here's a guy that has experience coaching, you know, younger players, developing players into greatness. Our organization is very young now. It's the perfect first step for him. And it's a safe, cheap hire for them. I could see Patrick Waugh entering a situation like that, you know, like what he's done with the Remparts is great. But I mean, I don't think anybody would argue that he's not always a pleasant coach to deal with. You know, Jonathan Marchessault had beef with him having come out of Major Junior when he was with Florida, stuff like that. So, I mean, it'd be interesting to see.
Yeah, I mean, before Mike Babcock got his earn it job, which hasn't even been announced yet with the Columbus Blue Jackets, there were rumors of Patrick going to Columbus. And yeah, now it's kind of resurfacing the idea of whatever one of the ownership groups that potentially will win the Ottawa Senators bid will look into him. I'm struggling with the same thing as JJ of like, I don't know which way to take this. I'm going to mention two things and you can choose a way to go. Number one, it's both regarding what you said about like winning and nothing else. The first one is that was very, very, very much apparent with the outdoor game. Seeing this guy go out of his way in the middle of a hockey season to get back in goalie skates and get in shape and skating at Family Sports during practice and running practices in pads, because not only is this an alumni game, but I got to beat the shit out of the Red Wings one last time and win this damn thing, where he put a lot of effort, it seemed like, from, you know, afar from the public perception, into getting back into it. And the second thing is what you just said about the Quebec Remparts is, if you guys watched, and this is to the listeners as well, if you guys watched the Memorial Cup, the Quebec Remparts whipped these other teams. They were unbelievable. Patrick Waugh has an unreal system there going. He seemed to have grown as a coach from what we saw with the Avalanche. Simone Gagné, I believe, is on his coaching staff. They were just an incredible staff, where it's like any other person, any other name that doesn't have what happened, what you were just explaining with his exit with the Avalanche several years ago, they would be a top every coaching list, because what he's doing in the queue right now is, you know, he's breaking records. He's doing an impressive job because winning is all that matters. But this past has kind of clouded over it. So let's go into both those things. Number one, let's touch on the outdoor game, because that was crazy. Yeah, and from there, let's go into, like, do you think that he can do it in the NHL again? Not just get the job, but actually succeed.
It's a tough, I'm going to go number two first and then number one. And I think it's a tough question. One of his, I think, biggest complaints with coaching at the NHL level, and this isn't going to improve coaching at junior, was the attention span of the younger players on the team was just not something that I think he was able to get his mind around in terms of coaching, right? Like, I forget, Brett Heimlich used to have me edit clips from, like, pull clips off of YouTube from movies, like, I don't know, like, old school or something, you know, just to throw something out there. I don't know that it was old school, but, like, he would have me, like, pull stuff that he could sneak into, like, his pre-scouts, like, his pre-game, whatever, power play thing, to break up the tedium and monotony of, like, just watching power play video, you know? Like, I know that was a thing that was a bit of a point of contention, was, like, how do I get the information to these guys in the bite-sized snacks that they are used to, you know, locking into? Another thing I'll say is, you know, I think supporting coaching staff matters a lot, but you saw Mario Duhamel and Andre Tourney. Duhamel was the video coach with the Avs, and Tourney was an assistant coach with the Avs when I started under Patrick Waugh. And I think there was, I don't know, I wasn't privy to conversation, I wasn't privy to interactions. I just, you know, you got the sense both of them left. You got the sense that they didn't feel like they had enough input on how things were going, because Patrick's way is Patrick's way. It's winning, nothing else, right? So, to me, questions are, has that changed? Like, is he more amenable to conversation? And maybe because Simone Gagné had a lengthy career, it's different. I don't know. Like, I was struck by watching Arizona's morning skate at their last game in Denver before the playoffs at the end of the season. I was watching Mario out there with the players, and, you know, he was having a great time. They were laughing. They were joking. They were loose. They were feeling good. You know, I talked to Tournier pregame, and I mentioned that the last time the Avalanche had played them, I don't know if you remember this, Arizona didn't have a shot in the third period, and the Avalanche also had a hard time scoring. And somebody asked McKinnon, and I followed up. I think it's Katie Goss asked McKinnon a question, and he kind of gave her a curt answer. And I followed up, you know, well, what were they doing? And that's when he said they were playing a 1-5.
Oh, yeah.
And he was talking about, he said, that's a different look. That's not something we'd seen from them before. I don't know when they started playing that. I asked Tournier about that in the morning skate, and he joked and he said, well, you go ask Nathan if he liked it. And if he liked it, then we'll change it. But if he didn't like it, then we're going to play a 1-5. You know, just joking around. But that got, you know, you got a sense of who those coaches were. And so that's something that I would want to know on a Patrick Waugh level. The other thing I'll challenge you to go do, both of you, is go watch the video of Patrick Waugh with the players post game from the Memorial Cup win, right? He's on the ice. He is pumped. The players are pumped. He is hugging every single player on the ice, right? But not every player on the ice is thrilled with that interaction with him. So go back through and watch the video. I don't know any of the dynamic. I don't know who any of these players are. I was watching the video with no audio on, and I was like, whoa, there's a couple of, like, awkward dude hug moments in this, where, like, there's a lot of, like, oh my god, we did it, here's a big hug. Not all of those. So that's where I look at that. But, you know, I do think that he has, I'll say this, I think a lot of goalies think that they can coach because they see a lot of hockey in front of them, but I do think that he has a hockey mind, and he has shown that he is capable of translating it. And this isn't necessarily a knock on Wayne Gretzky, but that's a guy who is an exceptional hockey player that couldn't seem to translate what he knew into coaching success, right?
Yeah. Real quick, before you get into the outdoor game thing, Jeff Merrick always says this. He says, Scotty Bowman was the type of coach that for 364 days of the year, his players hated his guts, and on 365, they get their cup ring. And that's kind of the vibe I'm getting from in the queue, not in the NHL, but in the queue. That's kind of the vibe I'm getting of like winning nothing else, winning above people liking me, winning above building those relationships with players where every single one of them will say good things about me. But in the end, winning is what he wants to do.
When I think we saw, maybe it was Emily Kaplan wrote a story for ESPN about coaches having to be more of a welcoming players coach these days, as opposed to the Scotty Bowman, you know, psychological warfare type of coach, the Mike Babcock style. You know, you get the sense Gerard Gallant has not stuck around with many teams for a prolonged period of time recently, that he may be one of those coaches. Daryl Sutter, that guy, when you start to hear reports of players saying, I'm not coming back if he's still here, you get the sense that they're those kinds of guys. So I don't know. People who are there and get to see him coach on the regular would have a better understanding than I would. You know, like there was no doubt that he wanted to win the Stanley Cup with the roster he had in front of him every season. But it just, you know, he didn't have a great roster either. That's part of it. Yeah. The first point, I thought it was an incredible experience to be there for his first day on the ice. And I had a ton of pictures, and I still have a ton of pictures. I tweeted that picture this year of him on the bench leaning against the boards talking to Peter McNabb. And that was day one of on-ice training for Patrick Roy, getting back in shape for the outdoor game. And, you know, he was dying out there. The pads were so heavy. The other goalie on the ice was Calvin Pickard, and I have a bunch of shots with like Pickard watching Wah, and Pickard was like, you got to send me every one of those. Like, keep taking pictures with me in them, because that was such a cool experience for him, right, to be out there. But that's, like I said, this is a guy who, and I know JJ has seen this, this is a guy who had a very heavy limp when he walked from the toll that playing goaltending took on him physically. And so he's still out there, you know, going butterfly, like reaching out, like doing what he can, even though he's older. Like, I'm sure it didn't feel good during and especially after, you know, and to go from playing in a game, being, you know, older, having these lingering, whatever, physical issues, if you want to call it that. Like, I don't know what they are, but to do that and then to switch gears into coaching, I think is tough too. Like, I don't know how that switch works at that level, right? But to get to experience that and just be around the team with that alumni game and that caliber of alumni game, like there have been alumni games, but this one had, I don't know, 12 Hall of Fame players or something in it when it was all said and done. Just an incredible experience. I almost got to put pads on for Joe Sakic. He was going to go shoot one day, and they didn't have a goalie, and Billington didn't want to go out there. And I was like, give me pads. I'll go out there and do it. I was like, you'll probably kill me. And I was like, I may not stop all of them, but I bet I could stop one or two, maybe, you know, early in the warm-up. But to me, one of the cooler experiences of the whole thing was we did like a family skate on the ice at Coors Field, and then we followed that up with a big reception for both current and former teams together. Mm-hmm. And I got to take my dad to that, and I know it was just a highlight moment for him. So he actually has these ancient hockey skates that have like a metal blade holder on them, like they are old. And we were up at the reception afterward, and Patrick Waugh, I went to introduce my dad, and he goes, you're the guy with those old hockey skates. And like, my dad was like, Patrick Waugh saw my skates out on the ice and like knew it was me, you know, just a great moment. The other great moment, I was just like, you know, oh, we're at this reception, we'll see who shows up. And like the first guy who comes in and comes over, Ray Bourque, you know, and I'm like, oh, look, dad, here's Ray Bourque. You know, at the same time, Eric Johnson comes in, I'm like, oh, here's EJ. You know, just a cool experience to have like all of the Hall of Fame Red Wings players, all of the Hall of Fame Avs players that everyone grew up watching, you know, this hated rivalry, all of these people, this wealth of experienced hockey player all in one room, just hanging out, schmoozing. It was a pretty cool experience.
Were you expecting a bar fight to break out?
No, not at that point.
Is there tension? Like, somebody keep an eye on McCarty. He can unleash at any moment.
I'm sure, you know, like everything you see, there's still a hatred, obviously, for some things. But it's, you know, I feel like Claude Lemieux could handle himself now, so it wasn't like a concern. But, you know, having grown up an Avalanche fan, the media day before the alumni game, it was just like, here, we're talking to Adam Foote, and we're talking to Claude Lemieux, and we're talking to Mike Ricci, and we're talking to Chris Simon, and we're talking to Sean Podine, and we're talking to all of these guys that you have, like, memories of.
Yeah.
We're talking to Mike Keane, we're talking to Dan Hino, we're talking to Peter Forsberg. You know,
I just remember just like, Forsberg's ice blue eyes. In person, they're even more than you ever thought they were on TV, and I'm just like, this is Peter Forsberg.
Forsberg's great. I love when the picture of him with the GoPro shows up. I love when it shows up natively. Like, it just showed up naturally. Somebody tweeted about it this year, and I, like, jokingly was like, man, I wonder who got him to wear that. It was like BR Open Ice or somebody tweeted about Peter Forsberg with the GoPro. And Michael Martin, the team photographer, he's like, I hate that picture because the GoPro's in it. And I'm like, yeah, sorry. But I got Forsberg to wear the GoPro for warm-up. I wish I could have gotten him to, like, wear it for the game, but I don't think that was on the table, really. And the only way I got him to do it was by kind of shaming Dan Hynote about it, who was sitting right next to Peter. And I was trying to get Hynote to wear the GoPro, and I wanted to hear, like, we were going to mic up Mike Keane, too, but Altitude ended up miking up Mike Keane, miking Mike. So I was trying to guilt Dan Hynote into wearing it, and he was getting ready. I'm like, come on, Dan, you said you'd wear it. And he's like, no, I don't want to wear it. I'm like, if you don't wear it, then I got to ask Peter to wear it, and Peter's not going to wear it. And he's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, GoPro. And he's like, what's that? I'm like, it's like a little camera. He's like, oh, I'll wear that.
That's so cool.
Like, oh, my God, Peter Forsberg's going to wear a GoPro for warm-up. I was like, I'm going to get so fired because John Martineau is going to be like, why does Peter Forsberg have a GoPro on his head? But then everybody thought it was awesome. You know, it's the whole experience was great. You couldn't see a thing from the press box for either game from where I was sitting. But every intermission, I would run all the way down to the locker room and do like a Periscope or a Facebook Live, like, interview with the players at intermission. So just like, Milan, how is it out there? Like, what's going on? You know, Craig Billington, talk to me about that huge save you made. You know, it was pretty cool.
I just remember there was one moment, I think it was Kirk Maltby was jawing at, I want to say, Ray Bourque or something. There was a weird, awkward moment in there where somebody was kind of jawing at someone in the middle of the alumni game. But it was such a fascinating, like, gentleman, sportsmanship, respect, but also, like, fuck you because you play on the other team and we hated you for so long. Like, I remember Steve Yzerman celebrating his goal, Joe Sakic celebrating his goal.
You could tell both teams wanted it.
They wanted it. Chris Chelios, I remember him being like a total heel in the introductions when he was introduced, and he was booing right back at the fans. Darren McCarty gave like a salute or something like that. 12 Hall of Famers and Ty Conklin for some reason was also there for the Red Wings. It was such a cool experience. And I was obviously there in the crowd. I wasn't going to miss that for the friggin' world. But it was such a fascinating experience. I remember Patrick Wall obviously ended up being the goalie that ended up winning the game for the Avalanche, and they won by a lot of goals, three goals or four goals or something. It was 5-2 at one point. I think Mike Ricci had a penalty shot at some point. It was just such a fascinating experience to kind of see Dan Hynote trying to run around a little bit. You can tell they had respect for each other. They knew they were all old, and like Patrick Waugh, you know, you're talking about him putting on, you know, pads and doing the butterfly and all that. He was 50 years old. Like, I can't even imagine what that feels like.
But he still moved the exact same way. Wild. Like, you see him do his little shuffle across the crease. I remember being like, that was Patrick Waugh I grew up watching right there.
Yeah, I remember that too.
When he came out day one with like brand new pads, right? And everybody was losing their mind. There's that goalie here Facebook group. Yeah, and then he hated him and went back to something else.
He wore Varleys.
There was a hilarious moment too where he came off the ice and he threw his glove and blocker into the crowd. I actually had somebody tweet me and they're like, I can't remember which one, the glove or the blocker. Like,
that's
I
so
have
cool.
his glove from the alumni game. But I remember showing the behind the scenes video that we made and spent hours and hours and hours working on. And there's a clip of him throwing that stuff into the stands. And Wayne Fleming, who used to be the head equipment manager back in the day, he goes, so that's where those went. And I was like, what do you mean? And he's like, he just came in, and I'm like, where's your glove and blocker? And he's like, oh, I don't know where I put them. Oh. He just lied about it.
Oh, that's hilarious. Oh, that's so great. I could go on and on with these Patrick stories.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that we're going to have to get Ryan on again this summer before the season starts up, because I still have three or four conversations here in my notes that I want to have, and we're already running a bit long. So, Ryan, can you come back on?
Yeah, I can. Let me give you one. My favorite moment with Patrick Waugh was we had an off day in Edmonton, and we were going out. It was like Mark Mosier and myself, and I don't remember who else, we were going to go out and find the Minnesota Wild game. It was the year where the Avs and the Wild were like in a dog race for the 8 seed, and it ended up coming down later to whoever won one game
and
out
Minnesota
of like the last week and a half. Nobody won, but Minnesota had one more point.
Yeah.
But we were in Edmonton, and we were like, let's go find a sports bar. It's, you know, Canada. Every hockey game has got to be on, right? That's hockey mecca in your mind. You think that's the case. So we're going out of the hotel, and another buddy of mine, Brandon Svitek, he used to work for Altitude. Now he's kind of he's an independent contractor. I think he does the remote, like not the net cam, but maybe behind the glass cam. He does like NBC playoffs, probably TNT playoffs. Like he travels all over. He does a lot of that. He was coming into the hotel from somewhere, and he's like, where are you guys going? I'm like, oh, we're going to watch the game. You want to come? And he's like, no, I'm good. And then right behind him coming into the hotel is Patrick. And he's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, we're going to go find a game or a place to watch the Wild game. And he goes, okay, I'll come with you. And then Brandon, who was like walking to the elevator, turns around. He's like, oh, I'll come too. And came out with us. And Mosier was just like nervous the whole time, you know, I think like fraternizing with coach staff kind of conflict maybe going on. But yeah, we went out to one bar and they're like, we don't have the Wild game. So then we left and we went to like a bed and breakfast that had a bar, and they're like, we don't have the Wild game. So then we went back to the first bar and we watched the Wild game on Mosier's phone, just sitting in a booth as like four of us, Patrick Waugh is one of us, just drinking beer and watching hockey on a phone with like implications for the team, you know, just on an off day. And you're just like, Is this real life? I guess this is real life.
What was Patrick Waugh's order? What's his beer of choice? Do you remember?
I don't. I'm sure it was light. You know, I'm sure it was a light drink. But we used to put down a lot of wine at dinner, go out to the steakhouse, a lot of bottles of The Prisoner. Eat well. There's the joke when you work in the NHL that it's the never hungry league.
Yeah.
It holds true.
That's funny. Yeah. Speaking of watching big games with the Minnesota Wild in Edmonton, and Patrick Waugh for that matter, I watched Game 7 of the 2014 playoff series at a Boston Pizza, famously known as the company owned by Brad Treliving's father. I watched Game 7 in a Boston Pizza in Edmonton, where for some reason, when Minnesota scored and won that game, the entire bar of Edmonton Oilers fans booed. And I think they were all going for the Avalanche. And I'm like, the Avs and the Oilers have had quite a few playoff series. When the hell did Minnesota become hated here? I didn't understand it, but I just remember that.
I was
vividly
at that game, and no one in the building knew that puck went in except for Varlamov and Nino Niederreiter. Yeah. And everybody was just, the building was silent as everybody's like,
no,
what just happened? And everybody in the press box was like, did that puck just go in? You know, just like, boom, game over.
Varley's body language. That was a tough one. Said it all. Varley's body language.
That was a tough one.
Yeah.
All right, Ryan. Well, yeah, we're going to have to cut it short. I think this breaks the record for our longest podcast we've ever put together here on Hockey Mountain High. But don't forget to check out Superbook Sports for all your Superbook sports.
Oh, yeah, the ad read. Way to go, JJ.
Oh, no, I knew. Just like we did with Kyle Fredrickson, I was going to do the plug-in.
Oh,
so,
good.
You know, I've got full control of what's going on here. As long as I don't get interrupted, this show runs smoothly. So thanks, Ryan, for hanging out with us. Arif. If you guys enjoyed the podcast, thanks so much for hanging out with us. If you made it this far in the podcast, bless your pretty little heart. Let's make hockey for everyone. We got you.